You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is BFM 89.9. I'm speaking to Martin Jakes, author of When China Rules the World. He's also a senior visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. So, Martin, how long did it take you to write this book and what kind of research did you do?
Well, the book took 11 years because it was interrupted for 5 years by the death of my wife, which rendered me unable to work on it for quite a period. So probably overall 4 years or so, one way or another. And the kind of research I did, well, it's very varied, actually. I mean, I did a lot of field research, interviewing lots of people, observing things, attending conferences, just all sorts of sort of probably more journalistic tools. And then there was the more academic side of it, of reading papers and above all reading lots of books.
Okay, but what sparked the interest in writing about China? I mean, it's a much written about subject already.
Well, originally my interest in the region was kindled by a holiday in 1993, when I went to Hong Kong and Guangdong province, Singapore and Malaysia. And I was forcibly struck by the modernity I found around me. And I was fascinated by the question, is this simply mimicry, a clone of the West, this modernity, or does it represent something distinctive? And that question remains a fundamental question in the book, even though it was on my mind from 1993. Because the book was interrupted by the death of my wife, when I returned to it in 2005, it was obvious to me that the second part of the book was had to be essentially about China. So in that sense, the book changed over time. But as anyone who reads the book and all the reviewers have said, it's a very different sort of book about China, which hasn't until now been written.
Okay, when you say China will rule the world, or when it rules the world, what exactly do you mean by that? Do you mean by economics, or are there other factors as well?
Well, first of all, I don't literally mean China will rule the world any more than America has ruled the world over the last 50 years. I mean that China will be, you know, the major hegemonic power, the dominant power in the world, but no dominant power ever has absolute power in the world, so... And I don't just mean economic. I mean, so far, virtually exclusively, the discussion about the rise of China has taken place in economic terms. Wow, look at that, is the sort of headline. And for some reason, it's not been China's rise has not been discussed in terms of wider political, cultural, military, maybe military a bit, implications. And yet, it's obvious that economic power is a precondition for the exercise and creates the conditions for the exercise of much wider forms of power.
Okay, so when you say, of course, we're talking about a cultural reach. Like we said in the past, it's mostly been focusing on economics. Has there been really much media attention focused on culture? I mean, it hasn't exported its culture as much as, say, the Western countries or Japan even, right? What makes China so different now? What's so unique about their culture?
Well, my argument is essentially that the rise of China, as the rise of any of the countries in the region, but especially the rise of China, because it's so large, because it's so distinctive, because it has such a different kind of history, will inevitably, Chinese modernity will express these differences. In other words, that Chinese modernity will not be simply a clone of Western modernity, but will have extremely distinctive features. And those features will express themselves not only in the nature of Chinese modernity, but also in the way in which China expresses itself as a global power.
So what are these most striking characteristics of Chinese modernity?
Well, I mean, even something as fundamental as the nature of the state in China is extremely distinctive from anywhere else. I mean, China really cannot primarily be described as a nation state. I mean, this is an entity, this is the political unit that's dominated international relations for a very long time, starting in Europe with what we know as the Westphalian system. China is not a nation state in any conventional sense. It calls itself a nation state. It has for 100 years. But it's existed for at least 2,000 years. And for 1,900 of those years, it was not a nation state. It was a civilization state. And the Chinese think of the way the Chinese think of themselves as Chinese, the characteristics that define their sense of identity are not derived from the last 100 years. They're derived from that much longer period of history. So China has got this very special characteristic of seeing itself as essentially a civilization. That's partly to do with just the sheer duration of China as a political entity. And it's also got a great deal to do, of course, with size, with the sheer weight of its population.
Does that mean you find that the Chinese population see themselves as one rather than separate? Because here in Malaysia, right, we have our government, and they try to fit a one identity to everyone. And that's essentially what a nation state does, makes everyone slightly equal. So how do you think China sees itself, even though, like you say, it's more civilization than nation state?
I think that that one of the characteristics of China as a civilization state is that the Chinese have a very powerful sense of belonging to a civilization, they have a very strong sense of being Chinese, today, I mean, one of the extraordinary features about China is that 93% of the population, you know, this is a colossal population, regard themselves to be Han Chinese. This is very, very different from the other world's most populous nations, like, in order, India, the United States, Indonesia and Brazil, all of which regard themselves to be fundamentally multiracial. But China doesn't really, except at the edges. Why? I think this is to do with mainly to do with its extremely long history, which has resulted in a process of melding and so on. Because the fact is that, of course, China is made up of countless races. Of course it is.
So it's ridiculous to almost assume that all of them are Han Chinese, 92%.
Well, it's a reminder that race is a cultural notion, a cultural construct, not a biological construct. Of course, the Chinese do, by and large, believe that it is a biological construct, but this, I think, is wrong.
Will that mean that because they see themselves, they associate themselves so much with the Chinese identity, there is a very strong sense of ethnocentricity there, making it very hard for people to penetrate the country or even create relations with the country?
I think that the Chinese do have a very powerful sense of identity. That is part of the reason why, you know, the differences which clearly exist in China between different regions and different cities and north and south, and by and large take second place to unlike India, for example, to this overarching sense of Chinese identity.
Okay, now in your book, you mentioned something about the Middle Kingdom mentality. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's an attempt to try and understand the way in which the Chinese see themselves and view their own history. And as probably many listeners will know, the term Middle Kingdom, which is what China literally means, was when the Chinese saw themselves as a sort of, you know, the center of the earth and the kingdom under heaven, and superior, far superior to all other cultures, which they regarded in varying degrees of barbarism. The Chinese therefore were very, in many ways, quite isolationist in their attitudes, because they didn't think they needed to mix and interact with other civilizations or other cultures, because they were superior and they couldn't learn very much. Of course, that became eventually an extremely debilitating condition, because they did need to learn from others, and now they are, of course, they have been learning ferociously in the recent period from others. But one of the fascinating things about the Chinese is, although they've lived through a very bad period until, you know, certainly 1949, what they call the century of humiliation, you know, opium wars and so on, occupation by foreign, by Western and Japanese countries and so on, the Chinese have retained a very powerful sense of self-confidence and self-assurance in a way that I think is strikingly different from virtually every other developing country. The Chinese have never let go of the idea that they are as good as anyone, well, actually probably a bit better. And this is a very powerful characteristic. And it's probably mainly drawn from the fact that they've had various dynasties, notably the Tang and the Song and the Ming dynasties, where China was an enormously creative civilization. But somehow this is tied by a line of continuity to the present. So, you know, you can say, well, Greek civilization had a very productive period, but then where is Greece today? The Roman Empire was less creative, but still was quite creative.
Yeah, where is Italy today? Persian Empire as well.
Yeah, so this is very different. So I think there's a lot of exceptionalism about China. Now, the difficulty, of course, there is a problematic side to any people that regard themselves with such self-confidence that borders on arrogance or a sense of superiority, and that is that they look down upon others. This is one of the things I discuss in my book.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station. You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
This is BFM 89.9. I'm speaking to Martin Jakes, author of the book When China Rules the World. Okay, now, as we can see, they are very influential now. Do you think China has to change its approach to dealing with things, especially with international politics? They are not very popular with a lot of other countries because of their stance on several issues. Do you think they have to be more lenient, more open, and rather than keep doing what they're doing now?
Well, I think I'd have to take issue with you on this. I think that over the Chinese have been good learners in this period, and they've picked up on serious problems of how they're perceived by others. And so in this region, for example, I mean, there were lots of suspicions of the Chinese in the 1990s, you know, a fear, well, it was bound up with all sorts of things, a fear of this huge country, problems about the relationship, perceptions about the relationship between China and the Chinese diaspora, communism, so on. There was lots of things. But in fact, you know, from the late 90s onwards, the last decade, the Chinese have pursued a policy of multilateralism in the region, seeking cooperation with ASEAN, a preparedness, which is extraordinary given Chinese history, to use the ASEAN template to find a resolution to its relationship in the region and so on. So I think that the Chinese have been prepared to be quite humble in this period, and also to play a very long game. You know, they are very good at playing a long game, because I think that's one of the lessons of being a civilization state.
They've learned patience.
Yeah, very great patience. And of course, that is enhanced in their minds by the fact that as they're growing so quickly, time is on their side.
But there is no doubt that there is huge, perhaps it's moral panic stirred up by the media, but just take a look at Australia when they wanted to buy up the various mining companies and the outrage that it caused. Mm. You know, is there anything China can do to perhaps better its image?
Well, I think that the Australian reaction, we need to sort of pick away a bit at the Australian reaction. I mean, there'll always be a certain reaction to China in terms of its sheer size. I think that that is a source of people's concern about China. Well, two things, I think. One is the sheer size of the population, but that is shared by India, and people don't have that view of India. But in addition with China, a sense that that it's a kind of homogeneous or monolith. It's neither, actually. It is very diverse, China is. Much more diverse than people give credit for. But there is that feeling about it. And, you know, it's an understandable feeling. Very strong state. India's got a weak state. Very important difference. So, China has to go out of its way, it seems to me, to be seen to be reasonable. But there's another side, isn't there, to the reaction of China, which is what I'll call a kind of a racial reaction, that China is so palpably different from and unlike the Caucasians who've dominated the world mm-hmm. for the last 200 years that people, you know, if it's an American company or a Chinese company taking over Rio Tinto, the reaction is going to be different in Australia. Probably American takeover would be acceptable, but a Chinese takeover is unacceptable. But that may change. That might change because people get used to it. I mean, now at the moment, it's such an unfamiliar thing to happen, but it won't be unfamiliar over the next 10 years.
Okay. In your book, you also mentioned something about the similarities between the communist period and the Confucius era are more striking than different. What do you mean by this statement, actually?
Well, I think one of the problems that particularly Western commentators have had in trying to understand China is that it's got a communist government. And therefore, it's been sort of bracketed in the mind with the Soviet Union. So many people felt in 1989, because it so happened that the fall of Berlin Wall and Tiananmen Square happened at the same time, that the Chinese communist regime was, you know, was going to suffer the same fate. And in that sort of monolithic thinking, the result is that the huge differences between the tradition, the Chinese communist tradition, and the Soviet communist tradition have been ignored and have been hugely underestimated. And I would argue that, and I argue this in the book, that many of the characteristics of Chinese communism, which, by the way, has been extremely flexible, in quite unlike the Soviet tradition, and has clearly a very deep indigenous roots, draws heavily from the Confucian tradition in many aspects. I think that not exclusively, it's not that China hasn't changed under Mao and then Deng Xiaoping and subsequently, but never underestimate the degrees of continuity. They are very powerful. And the Confucian tradition dates back, you know, thousands of years. So, of course, it's going to remain. Old ideas and attitudes and habits they linger, they persist. In whatever country, and this is certainly true in China.
Do you think their sense of identity has helped China essentially succeed where the Soviet Union failed?
Definitely. I think that one of the reasons why the Soviet Union disintegrated was that, remember, Russians only composed half the population of the Soviet Union. And the breakup started in Eastern Europe because Eastern Europe was, you know, were sovereign countries, albeit with severely limited sovereignty because of the role of Soviet tutelage. And then the other countries that started breaking off were the non-Russian parts of the Soviet Union, leaving Russia and a bit plus. You know, that was the end. That was the story. China, that was never going to happen. It was utterly naive of people to think that China was going to break up because China, it didn't understand, you know, the ethnic makeup of China and the way in which the Chinese perceive themselves. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, that, you know, the Han Chinese, there's no experience in modern times of China breaking up. There's experience of China growing, but not breaking up. And the only parts of China that are likely to break off there are only two ethnic groups in China which feel extremely uncomfortable with Han rule. One are the Tibetans, and mm-hmm. the second are the Uyghurs. There are only 10 million Uyghurs, and there are around 6 million Tibetans. We're talking about a population of 1.3 million, a billion, mm-hmm. sorry.
All right. So in order to sum up the whole interview, what are the eight characteristics that really define China?
Eight?
Okay, some of the characteristics then.
Well, it's true I talk about eight in my book. First of all, it's a civilization state, not primarily a nation state. Secondly, for thousands of years, East Asia was subject to an international order which we call the tributary state system. It's only 100 years since it existed, and I would expect, as China regains its position at the center of the East Asian economy, that elements, echoes of the tributary state system will probably be reproduced. Thirdly, it's got a very unusual attitude, a different attitude, conception of race, and the result of that is a weak conception of difference. So a lack of respect, I think, is of difference, which I think is clear in Xinjiang and it's clear in Tibet. And as a global power, China, one of the, my biggest worry is probably China's inability to understand difference on a global basis. That's a big question, I think. Fourthly, that the Chinese state is constructed in a very different way from the Western state. It enjoys a lot more legitimacy, a lot greater deference from the population, and is regarded in a much more intimate way, actually. It's the representative of Chinese civilization. No obvious boundaries, no obvious competitors. This is very, very different from the Western state. Hugely competent state, much more probably the most competent state in the world, even though it's only a developing country. So, I mean, obviously, the fact that it's got a communist government is also a very distinguishing characteristic of China. But that should be seen in the context also of the Confucian tradition, which are the two things, but above all the Confucian tradition, which make up the Chinese outlook. Now, there are five to be going on with for now.
All right. Okay, so in your honest opinion, should every one of us start picking up Mandarin?
Well, I think Mandarin is going to become a much more important language. I mean, why did English become the global lingua franca? It's quite a recent development. People think it's been around for a long time. It's not. Really, its development as a lingua franca has been since the 1950s, 1960s. We're talking about 50 years. Why? Although I'm British, I think it's got nothing, not very much to do with Britain. It's got to do with America and an American hegemony over that period. So, I mean, over time, with the rise of China, which I think will become the dominant nation and I think will ultimately replace the United States, along with other countries like India and so on, but China will be the most important, then its language will become much more important. I mean, all things about China will become more important. And so I suggest it would be a good idea to, at least for the next generation, to be learning Mandarin.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Martin Jakes. I was speaking to Martin Jakes, author of When China Rules the World. He is also a senior visiting fellow at the London School of Economics, and you're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.